Hello and welcome to this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. This is episode 54. My name is Perry Middlemas and I'm here with my scripturient friend, David Grigg.
Yo, what? What does this word mean?
Scripturient. I looked it up and it, well, I had to because I didn't know it. And it actually means not so much obsessive, passionate about writing.
Yeah.
So I thought that probably fits you quite nicely, David.
I suppose it does. But yes, you have to spell it out for me. I think I have to put it on my resume or something.
Scripturient.
Wow.
So it's like script with purient at the end of it.
I'm not so sure that I like that.
No. It's just scripturient. Anyway, so there we go.
Okay.
So what have you been up to?
It's a bit hard to be up to much at the moment, of course, because we're in yet another lockdown. Hard lockdown. Not allowed to go more than 5 kilometres from home.
And no, only, 10 now.
Is it 10 now?
Okay, yeah, it's 10 now. Yeah, that's lucky because my wife and I like to go to Victoria Market to get our meat and vegetables, and we're able to do that on Friday just.
Oh, very good, very good.
Couldn't do it on Thursday, but we could do it on Friday, so that's it. But we spoke massively about lockdowns and everything.
We won't bore people anymore. We're keeping our fingers crossed that it'll all be lifted soon.
Yes, we hope so. I hope that it basically finishes up sometime by the end of this week. I'd like to be able to get out and about and just wander around a bit. That would be good.
Sure.
So what else is happening in your world?
I'm still plugging away on projects for standard ebooks.
Oh, good.
Doing a very, very difficult job at the moment. There's one particular book I'm working on, which has got a zillion notes written by the editor at the back of the book, and it refers all to page numbers throughout the book, there are no page numbers in ebooks, and so I've got to find every little reference that he's referring to. You know, on page 365, where the author uses this term here, he means this. Okay, so I've got to find the term. I've got to put in the little hyperlink that makes it an endnote, and then use the comment he made about it to be the endnote itself. It takes a long time, and I'm up to 300 such notes so far, and I haven't finished.
Well, I would normally say it keeps you off the streets, David, but in this instance, you're not allowed out there anyway.
It's just keeping me off the streets. Yeah.
So there you go. You're allowed to basically sit at home and just...
To give you a clue, I'm actually taking a break so hard. I'm taking a break for it, and for relaxation for standard ebooks. I'm going to do Charles Dickens's Little Dorrit for relaxation.
Oh, the things we do.
To keep
ourselves amused in this interesting time.
Indeed.
Well, it is an interesting time as well in the science fiction field, David, because we've discussed in the past the Hugo Awards and Nebula Awards as being the major two awards in the field. And it's interesting to note that the Nebula Awards were handed down or announced on the weekend.
Uh-huh.
Now, these are the ones that are handed out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and are for works that have been published in the previous calendar year in English in the United States. So that's what you have to be wary of. That,
yep.
And this is the thing that I was finding when I was looking. Well, we have found when we've been looking at some of the Hugo Time Machine stuff that the Nebula Awards don't cover things that were covered that were published originally in the United Kingdom. They had to be published in the US. So that's sometimes the reason why certain stories or novels don't actually make their final ballot, because they're basically ineligible, which is a bit of a nuisance. But things are a little bit better now on the basis that really everything is available to everybody because they can say, oh, well, it's an e-publication as well, which means that it is available easily in the United States, even if it originated from Europe or South America or Asia or anywhere else other than the US, it probably should be available. So then theoretically, everything is going to appear. Anyway, be that as it may, that's a discussion for another time. But I thought I'd just go through the winners of, the major winners from the Nebula Awards. I won't go through the whole the whole lot, but make a few comments along the way, if I may. The winner of the novel was Network Effect by Martha Wells. This is one of the Murderbot series, the novel, first novel in the Murderbot series. One that I'd hope to get to by about now, but I have been busy reading other stuff. Some things for this podcast, and some things from other projects that I'm working on. It beat out probably our favourite in Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. But anyway, so Network Effect seems to be pretty popular. You would have to think it's probably now favourite to win the Hugo later in the year, though. It doesn't always go that whatever wins the Nebula wins the Hugo, but I think it will be up there in the top two or three. Let's put it that way. The novella, won by Ring Shout by P. Dajelly Clark. I have actually read this and thought it was a very interesting take on racism in the American South in the 1920s. I have some reservations about it. I think I've talked about it on the podcast, but when it comes time to the fact when I've read all of the novellas for the Hugo, I will lump them all together and we'll talk about those specifically. And I might fling one or two to you for you to have a bit of a read so that you can come in and put your two bobs worth in as well, David, so we can see how
Sure.
that goes. But anyway, so I would have thought that Ring Shout was probably going to be one of the favourites, and there it is. It won. Novelette, I haven't read any of these, but Two Truths and a Lie by Sarah Pinsker. Sarah Pinsker is an excellent writer. I've read a bit of her work over the last few years, and so I wouldn't be at all surprised, or I'm not at all surprised to see that she picked up the Novelette Award. Short story. Open House on Haunted Hill. Shades of a certain favourite of yours
Shirley
with that one.
Jackson,
Yeah.
maybe.
This was written by John Wiswell from originally published in Diabolical Plots. I should have mentioned that the Sarah Pinsker was a Tor.com online novelette. And Ring Shout was from Tor.com, and oddly enough, Network Effect was also from Tor.com.
No, they're a good
They
publisher
were
in
they, well, they do some
genre.
they do a heck of a lot of work. In fact, I think, and let me just check here, I have a feeling that yes, no, all bar one, no, two, sorry. In the Hugos, I believe that all of the novellas are published by were originally published by Tor.com. In the Nebulas, there's two that aren't. So three out of the five. One, two, three, four out of the six. My apologies, they are up to six as well. Four out of the six nominees were also from Tor.com. Now, we also have a few other awards for the Nebulas. Game writing, which I know absolutely zero about. This was won by Hades, Greg Kasavin, publisher Supergiant. Now, the Ray Bradbury Award is a newish award. It's for a script, I believe. This is won by an episode of The Good Place, whenever you're ready. I'm not following The Good Place, but it has been picking up awards with the Hugos over the last few years, and sooner or later I'm just going to have to go and just check it out. I looked at one or two episodes and I thought, didn't think it was for me, but anyway, obviously I'm not in tune with everybody else in terms of what they do. The Andre Norton Award is for a young adult fiction, and this was won by T. Kingfisher for a novel called A Wizard's Guide to Defensive Baking.
Okay.
Interesting title, interesting title. But that's the major list of the Nebulas. You'll notice, David, that the Nebula Awards, as you're probably aware, because it's a basically professional set of awards, they don't have any fanish categories at all. So they don't have
No.
anything for best fan writer, best fan artist, best fanzine, none of that sort of stuff. And That's fair enough. They also don't have things like Best Semi-Prozine or Semi-Professional or Professional Magazine either. But the fannish ones are the ones that they leave out because they leave those to the Hugo Awards each year. Now, this sort of when I looked at that, and I sort of realised, oh yeah, I should make a comment about that particular section of the Nebula Awards. And it struck me, David, that we've had a discussion in the past about how you came to read science fiction and what your early influences were in terms of reading science fiction, but we really didn't ever get into fanzines per se, nor how you got into fandom. So, well, maybe it's best if we have a bit of a go at looking at what fanzines are, because there's a lot of people around who are a little bit unsure about what a fanzine really is. And I know that we've discussed this, and you've actually done a bit of research into this. So, would you like to be able to define what you think a fanzine is for me?
Sure. Well, it's put simply, it's an amateur magazine, and it combines the word fan with magazine to make fanzines. Interestingly enough, it took quite a while for that term to come about. The initiating impulse for the idea of fanzines was really the letter columns of the science fiction magazines back in the 1920s. And those magazines, particularly Amazing Stories, had huge letter columns, or big letter columns, which had letters from science fiction fans commenting on the stories in the magazine. But they included the full addresses of the people who were writing in. And so fans could see other people's addresses and write to each other. And that apparently was is considered to be the source of the original idea of fans talking to each other outside of the major professional magazines, and therefore that led to the idea of amateur magazines coming along. So they started off probably in the sort of late 30s, early 40s, but the term fanzine itself was coined by a chap called Russ Chauvenet in the October edition of his fanzine Detours. This is all out of Wikipedia. It's a good article on Wikipedia if you look. Interesting thing about Russ Chauvenet, even though this is a very euphonic term, fanzine, is that he was stone deaf.
So what era are we talking about here?
This is sort of 1940 is when he coined the term. All these little magazines, these amateur magazines, came up from there using a variety of different printing methods. Initially, people were circulating these things with on the basis of carbon copies. Remember what carbon paper was, Perry?
Oh, yes.
Many of our young listeners won't have a clue about any of this stuff because it's the technology has just moved on so much. And then it led to other printing devices. Now, I'm not going to bore everybody with all this, but I just thought we should have a bit of a background as to where the whole term came from and what it is. And of course, from the science fiction field, the term fanzine and their concept of the idea of a fan magazine spread to the music industry, where the fans of particular artists started to put out fanzines to do with the music, and into other media. So, but it did start in the science fiction field.
Oh yes, I've seen and read UK football fanzines and cricket fanzines
Oh,
as
yeah.
well, and you could almost basically say that the weblog is a an extension
Very much so.
of a fanzine.
Yeah.
But over the years, fanzines changed quite a lot,
Oh, yeah.
and they started picking up all these other different names as well, Circon Gen zines, which I mentioned to somebody recently, and they just looked at me like I was literally speaking a foreign language, which pretty much are. But as in the way of the term fanzines, these are all basically concatenations, abbreviations and concatenations of various other words, and brought down into something that makes it a lot easier to say. So a Circon zine is a serious constructive critical magazine, and a Gen Zine's a fanzine for general distribution. There are also per zines or personal zines, and something that we have both of us have close to our hearts, David, is appa zines or an appa. Now, you actually happen to be at the moment the official bloody editor of the Australian and New Zealand Amateur Publishing Association, or ANZAPA.
I
Do you want
am.
to give us a bit of a brief overview about what ANZAPA is?
Well, I will, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll actually, you started off by asking me about how I got into all this, and in fact, ANZAPA was how I got into all of this.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a
And
good
so
apprentice way around.
it works fairly well. Yeah, I've told the story many times before, and according to my friend Kerry Hanfield, I get the story wrong most of the time, but basically, he introduced me to John Bangzand. And John Bangzand introduced us to the idea that there was this thing called ANZAPA, or this organization which allowed people to put together these amateur magazines and circulate them and have other people read them. Now, to me at the time, this was a huge revelation. It's a bit like, imagine some teenage kid who's been living on a desert island and suddenly gets introduced to modern society, and somebody says to him, "There's this thing called Facebook where people can talk to each other and tell people what they've been doing, and other people will comment on it." You can imagine that sort of revelation of, my God, there are people out there who I can write to and actually will look at what I've written and come back with comments about it and have this correspondence about it. And so that, to me, discovering that that was the case was a real revelation, because I'd started out wanting to be a writer, wanting to be a science fiction writer, and I'd convinced my parents to buy me a typewriter by the age of 12. For my 12th birthday, I got my first second-hand typewriter. It was second-hand from an office, and I taught myself to type. I taught myself to touch type by the time I was 15,
That's pretty good.
so I could write these stories. So I was already heavily into writing, and I had the equipment, and so even though this wasn't fiction, the idea of being able to write to other people through this concept of an APA, this Amateur Press Association, where each individual person who's a member of that organization puts together their own little amateur magazine, sends, in those days anyway, sent in 25, 30 copies to the official editor of the APA, who would then collate them all together and send everybody out a parcel full of all everybody's individual little fanzines. Terrific concept. Goes way back, the idea of that goes way back to the late 1800s, I think, among people who were interested in amateur press, amateur publishing, in the sense of literally letterpress magazines of using their own equipment to print fancy magazines and things. So it goes back that far. But that's how I got into fandom, because my introduction was ANZAPA. It was the concept of fanzines, being able to publish what I thought, have other people comment on that, and have this back and forth, even though it was every 2 months. It wasn't like a quick back and forth like is these days with Facebook, but it was still an outlet for someone who really hadn't had that sort of outlet before. So yeah, that was really what sucked me into the whole idea of fandom, was ANZAPA.
You say you said there that the frequency of them was every 2 months. There are some around that have been monthly, and some I think even now are actually weekly.
There were a couple of weekly APAs around in the 70s, I think, but I think they were a club-based thing.
Yeah,
People would
they
turn up
are.
each week to the club and submit.
So basically, I think what happens there is that somebody will do a 2-4 page piece, a small magazine, two or four pages, take it along with all the requisite number of copies. They do the collation there, and then everybody goes home on the specific night with their copy of the mailing, as it is referred to. So we're both members of ANZAPA, and it's actually now one of the longest running science fiction appers in the world. A whole lot of them have fallen by the wayside these days, and they've just slowly disappeared. And ANZAPA, a couple of years back, 2018, I think it was, had
That's right.
its 50th anniversary.
Yeah, so it's coming up to 53.
Coming up to 53, and there are people that are in it at the moment who were there at the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Our friend Lee Edmonds, friend of this podcast, we've interviewed him a few times, and I know he's listening to he listens to it, so he tells me. So he's been in it for quite a large period of time.
Yeah, not continuously. I don't think anyone's been in it for the whole of the 53 years,
No,
or even
I think
close to
that.
it. I don't know who would be even longest, actually. It'd be interesting to know.
Yes, there are a few that have consecutive numbers, like Bruce Gillespie's up to, I don't know, his little Anzapazine called BRG is up to about the 120s or thereabouts. So he's been in it for a heck of a long time.
Oh, but longer than that. I mean, that number doesn't add up.
No, it
He
doesn't
had
add up to
different
everything that he's
he
done.
had different titles before that.
But even so, even if that's even if he has one different one issue per mailing, that's still 20 years worth. So it sort of it builds up, it builds up. So we've also been involved with other fanzines ourselves in the past, not just Apozines as well. That you produced a few fanzines way back when in the early
Way back
seventies,
when.
way back when in the early seventies.
Yeah. So after discovering fandom, after discovering the joys of publishing fanzines, yes, every 2 months wasn't enough. And so I started to get into publishing quite a lot of individual little titles. I actually won an award at a convention, I think in about 1970, maybe 1972, something like that, 71, 72. I got the Paul Stevens Golden Caterpillar Award for something like productivity in fanzine producing or something. I think I produced about 20 or 30 fanzines in the previous year. And so he gave me this silly little award, but which I unfortunately I no longer have. But yeah, so I published a whole lot of individual things. My first gen zine, as to use that term, general distribution fanzine, was called The Fanarchist. And just sort of play on words again. And apparently it went for 8 issues, but I had forgotten that fact until Kim Hewitt came out with his Index to Australian Fanzines a couple of years ago. And lo and behold, apparently I produced 8 issues of that. It's amazing. But and then I had one running for a while, which was called Touchstone. And I also majored a lot in names. Fanzine titles which were from Lewis Carroll, the Slithy Tove and etc. That sort of fanzine title. So they were a lot of fun.
So what do you think your major reason behind producing a fanzine really was? What were you getting out of producing a fanzine like a gen zine like the Fennecist that you weren't getting from an APA? What was the
Well, I
difference
think.
between the two?
Well, wider distribution, of course, because an APA generally only has 20, 25 members, something like that. And so, Genzine, you could distribute more widely. And the other thing that people did with fanzines, maybe I presume they still do, is that you would swap with other people. So, rather than paying someone to subscribe to their magazine, you'd swap for your magazine with theirs. So it was a currency, if you like, sort of means of currency of swapping for these other people's magazines. But I just enjoyed the whole writing process, and I was already, I think, starting to like the idea of laying things out and so on. Of course, in those days, the technology was very primitive, and so I was using this old second-hand Olivetti typewriter for. The first 5 6 years of my fanzine production. It wasn't until later that I could afford. I had a job and could afford to buy a better typewriter. Throughout that time, as the technology improved, I was always keen to make things look as good as I could with it in the with the limitations of the technology. And you were able to include illustrations and things, cartoons and so on. But the technology was awfully primitive. Back in those days, mostly what I was using was the Ronio duplication method, which, if you remember, Perry was essentially you got a special sheet, which had a wax layer, and behind that was a sort of a bit of carbon paper, and then a sort of final backing sheet, and you'd put that in your typewriter and disconnect the ribbon. This was a thing I learned quite after my first fanzine. After my first fanzine, you disconnect the ribbon, and then you basically the keys of the typewriter hitting, basically cutting holes into the stencil, and then you wrap this whole thing around a drum which has got ink coming through it, and the ink goes through the little holes you've cut and produces a copy. But that's all very well for type. But what do you want if you wanted to include an illustration or a cartoon or something? What do you do? Well, there was this magic thing called electrostencils, and it was this special machine that it'd be like a scanner, and it actually cut little tiny holes in a special, I think it was a vinyl sheet rather than a wax sheet, cut the little tiny little holes based on the scan, and so you could reproduce this illustration. But they were expensive, and there was one particular fan whose name I should remember, but I've now forgotten, who bought one of these machines, I think for a business, and you could go and pay him a bit of money, and he'd with a whole bundle of illustrations, and he'd produce these electrostencils for you. And of course, because it was so expensive, you put lots of little illustrations all over one big sheet of paper. And then when you got them home, you actually cut the bit out that had your particular illustration that you wanted to use in that particular page. And then you glued it. You cut out a hole in the wax stencil, and you glued it to the wax stencil. And then that whole thing went through the Rhenium machine and produced the little illustration. So there was a lot of technology to it. Technology which today sounds incredibly primitive, and it was. But we're so lucky these days with photocopying machines and computers.
It was the old cut and paste.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. You actually literally had to cut with scissors and paste with glue.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
even when it got down to the stage of photocopying, a lot of the time that's what we were doing. You'd type it out onto a fair copy, leave a gap, and then cut and paste your illustration into fit so that it could come out. But you had to be very careful about using around the edges of the piece that you cut out so that you didn't get a shadow, so that you had to basically check it first, and if it had too much, then you had to go back and dab a whole lot of liquid paper all over it to make sure that there was nothing showing, because there's nothing worse than having an illustration in the corner where you can see where the cut mark goes all the way right around it in such a weird way to fit in with the rest of the text.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was just a lot of good fun, wasn't it?
Oh,
It was
yeah.
just a means of, as you say, just keeping in touch with people here and overseas. And in many ways, without the concept of fanzines, it would have been impossible for Australians to keep in touch with people overseas in the early 70s and late 60s and early 70s. It just
Yeah.
would have been impossible. And without that, of course, then you wouldn't have had AussieCon, the first Australian Worldcon in 1975. And probably not 85. It was only 99 when we were able to do a lot of our communications with people overseas via email that things started to change a bit. Now, of course, it's all email and you don't really basically send anything at
Yeah,
all.
that's right. That's right.
And so, of course, you even get everything's changed markedly now, of course, because of the cost of reproduction is high now in comparison to what it used to be. And postage is
Yeah,
very
skyrocketing.
expensive and slow. And so what we've ended up doing, well, what you proposed as editor of NZapper was to move to a fully digital version of the apper. Do you want to explain what's happened there?
Yes, well, the pandemic had a fair bit to do with it, but I think this would have happened anyway. But when the pandemic hit, and nobody was at that stage, very at the early stages of the pandemic, very certain about whether the virus could be transmitted on surfaces or not, the official editor, who at that stage was Bruce Gillespie, with my support, sort of said, "This is a dangerous thing to be doing. Here we are getting together a whole bunch of bits of paper, shiny bits of paper in some cases, from all over the world, bundling them all up, handling them, physically handling them to collate them, bundling them all up and sending them back out all over the world." Now, if it had been the case that the virus was easily carried by surfaces, then that would have been a tremendously, well, it would have been just not the right thing to do. And so that was kind of the initial impulse to say, hang on, maybe at least during the pandemic, we shouldn't be doing this. How can we keep the organization going? Well, the suggestion was that we all produce PDF versions of the fanzines and distribute those instead. And so I was able to come up with a system which I felt was as easy as possible for the members to deal with, even those who were not particularly computer literate. So that's what we did. We moved to a system where people sent in a PDF copy of their fanzine. I put it all together and then distribute that, the collated version, almost as though it was the paper thing, but it's all electronic these days. It's all done via the internet. And that seemed to work pretty well. And so people are now pretty happy with that. It brought in a number of people who'd been members in the past who dropped out because it was all too difficult and expensive to keep handling paper that way. And we had an election, oh, a couple of months ago, maybe 4 months ago, to decide really between whether we're going to keep going with PDF versions or whether we were going to go back to doing things with paper. And pretty decisively, we decided very decisively, we decided to keep going with the PDF version. So that's how it will be, I think, into the future, unless there's some very, really radical change or the internet collapses or something. We will see.
Well, I can say for myself that it certainly makes things a heck of a lot easier for me, in that I don't really have access to any cheap reproduction method, either a work photocopier or a Roneo or any sort of duplication devices at all. And I think we'd struggle to go back to stencils now, David. I don't think you'd be able to buy them.
Oh, okay. The supplies. You wouldn't get the supplies.
No, I don't think you'd be able to buy them anymore. I wouldn't have much of a chance of being able to produce anything without it being electronic. And I think it's changed the dynamic of fanzines and fanzine fandom, though. I think there's not so much. People don't feel so much the obligation to respond when they receive a fanzine by electronic means. And so if you are producing one of these things, that's one of the things you've got to be mindful of, that you may not necessarily get the response that you might have received if you had sent something via paper. But that's just one of the things that changes. And I think people not writing comments so much on fanzines or on anything very much these days. Although that being said, we have to say that over the last 5 or 6 mailings of Ann Zapper, it's averaged out at over 500 pages a pop.
Well, see, that's part of the danger is that people don't feel restrained because they're not restrained by cost anymore.
So they just have a tendency to rabbit on about everything under the sun. I at least try to keep myself mostly constrained, but at least on my comments anyway. There are some people that oh no, I shouldn't. I'm being churlish here. Really, what it comes down to is it's good to be able to read everybody's the stuff that they're talking about. But it's a interesting but very weird conversation, David, when you're thinking about replying to somebody who has written a comment to somebody else when the original thing they are commenting on was published 4 months ago, and they are not going to see it for another 2 months. So it could end up being 6 months between the original piece and you actually getting your point into them so
But
that they can see.
in today's frenetic world,
It's
this kind of
good.
very slow-paced conversation is like, it's got something to it, I think.
So
It's
why is it? So why is it then,
it's
David?
vaster than empires and more slow,
So why is it then, David, that all these people in Zappa seem to keep saying, "Oh, I'm really rushed to finishing this off."
As I saw yesterday, I'm certainly always scratching to get finishing to it.
There's so many people that basically say that they get the app and oh yeah, I'll get to it. I'll get to it. I've got 2 months, and then suddenly, about 2 weeks before the deadline, they suddenly realise, Ooh, crikey, I better do something about this. I better get onto it because I haven't done anything about it at all.
It's just habits from school, you know, not doing your homework until the night before. That's what it comes
Yes,
down to.
never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. But it also means that I think this exactly the same thing used to happen when people used stencils, which made it even harder and tougher to
Oh,
get
yeah.
the stuff finished. People, it's just a thing that people do, but it is just funny that you see, well, you can, well, you have a look at the last one, basically. The deadline for the mailing was what, last Friday, and
Yep.
on Saturday you produced it, and there it was. It was in all its glory there for download. I must admit, I did actually start reading it that afternoon, sort of undertaking what in the trade is known as ego scanning. That is, for those people who aren't aware, you get a magazine and you start looking for your name to see whether you have been mentioned at all by anybody else. Because people will write comments to you about the stuff that you've done a couple of times, a couple of mailings back, or the previous mailing, and you want to basically see first off what it is that they've said about you, and that then becomes part of the conversation. You know, it's the first thing you read. You know, so what have they said about me this time? And to find out how often you're being mentioned, and to get an indication as to whether or not people are actually reading your material. Some people read all of it. Some people don't. I must admit, I don't read all of ANZAPA or all 500
Well, it's a lot
pages.
to get. 500
It's
pages, a heck of a lot to get through. I don't
there's
know
a
how many.
lot, and some of the font sizes are pretty damn small, I can tell you. But that oh, and see, that's the other thing about electronic publications. If the font size is too small, you just bump it up, just magnify it a bit. And finally, for old geezers like you and I, David, we can basically actually read this
That's
stuff.
right, yeah.
Whereas if you go back and have a look at some old issues of Bruce Gillespie's or John Bengtson's, where they used to have that sort of really pico font size, which was probably about 7 or 8, and you try and read it, you think, God, I better hunt down a magnifying glass to be able to get through this. This is not a criticism at all, Bruce, if you're listening to this, not at all. It's purely just a comment about font sizes, which 20, 30 years ago had absolutely no trouble with whatsoever. But these days, I do have trouble with them.
Sure.
But actually, what's interesting about all this with the electronic stuff as well is that it allows for us to get access now to a lot of that old material that is being scanned in to and then uploaded to web pages such as Fanac and eFanzines. And if you go hunting around through either of those two sites, you'll find, for example, pretty much every issue of Bruce Gillespie's science fiction commentary, starting in 1967 or 1968. You'll find all the issues of a magazine that Erwin Hirsch and I did back in the late 80s called Larrikin. There was about 22 or 23 of those. And so, I mean, that's 35 years ago that we did that. But they're all there and they're available. And they look completely fresh because, sure, they're not on paper, but there they are on the screen, and you can see them with the paper color and the illustrations and everything that's there. There's just a full scan of a lot of this material, and I think that's an excellent project. It's one of those ones that we were talking about a while back. That's one of the ones that I've been involved in, putting a lot of John Bengtson material up on the web so that people can go back and read it. Because a lot of material that is very old is either, well, there's not much of it around. A lot of it's been chucked out over the time, so it's been discarded. Some of it's rather fragile and is not going to last that long. And it is good now to be able to have an electronic version of these things that's sitting up there in the cloud. And people are downloading it all over the place and being able to read it. So it's, you know, you can go back and read an old John Bengtson and fanzine from 1970, 50 odd or so years old, and it's just like you got it in the mail yesterday. And it's great. It's a really interesting part of really well, to me, it's a really interesting part of fandom, the fanish history and the old fanzines, I think, really make really make fandom for me a lot these days.
Sure.
For a long period of time back in the late 90s and 2000s, I was involved in running conventions. I'm not doing that anymore. And I will state that again, that I'm not doing
Very
that anymore, even
sensible.
though people seem to be insisting that maybe there's another one in me. No, there is not. Absolutely not. I'd much rather basically be doing fanzines and dealing with them much more, much better for my current lifestyle, I think, David.
Mental health, anyway, that's for
Well, it
sure.
is also for the mental health as well. You don't want to basically go through that. Too hard, just too hard.
See, in a way, well, certainly fanzines brought me into wider fandom, and I did silly things like establish the Melbourne University Science Fiction Association a little while after I started into fandom, and. But I also then got involved in running a few things, not to the extent that you did, but in a way I ended up. It's a long, sad story, but I in a way I ended up as the chairman of the 1985 convention through my interest in publications, because I was keen to be involved in sort of the publication side of the. Of the convention that was coming up. And at that stage, of course, it was run by the chairman was John Foister, and I turned up to a lot of meetings and so on. And it seemed that I was one of the few people who turned up to all the meetings that John had about the upcoming convention. And somehow I ended up being nominated as being the vice chairman of the convention, which in retrospect was a fatal mistake.
Bells were ringing.
And then when John, through various reasons, really wasn't able to continue, I ended up there. I was the chairman, but it was very much the it's like one of those things where in the jerky thing of everyone who wants to volunteer take one step forward, and all the soldiers take one step backwards, apart from the idiot who isn't sort of th thinking or isn't didn't actually hear the command. And okay, you volunteered, soldier. Well, it was kind of like that. That's how I ended up to being chairman of 1985.
Last man standing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, I think that in many ways you and I came into fandom in similar ways. We might have had a contact via people, but our first interests both were in fanzines, and it still continues. It'd be nice if we were seeing a lot of younger fans basically producing this material. I'm not sure that there is all that are all that many around there producing. Most of the ones that I see are from people that are of a similar age or
Well, I mean, the younger people would say, "What's the point of this? We'll just go on Twitter, or we'll go onto Facebook or Instagram, and we'll that's our contact with our friends. That's our contact with other fans. That's where we talk about this stuff. Why would we put something together in an actual publication that then has to be distributed, or heaven forbid, put it on paper? But even electronically." Yeah, I can see a lot of young people thinking, "What's the point of all this?" But the point is that as I started out, really, and Zapper and fanzines were my Facebook, my equivalent of Facebook. It was my gateway drug to being in contact with other people in a way I hadn't been able to do before. And so I can see that young people today would say, well, that's what Facebook or whatever does for us. It's the kind of thing that really got me into fanzines, is the same impulse, the desire to communicate with other people.
Yes, I can see that, but I can also see the point that with a fanzine where you're actually going to write a longer piece than just a two or three paragraph post that you're going to put up on Facebook, you get a chance to actually consider a topic or a subject, and you can write it, then you can change your mind, and you can rewrite it, and you can throw it out. Then you can come back to it again and look at it again, and then come up with something that you think that you're happy with. Whereas in a throwaway Facebook age, people just type things and then just move on, and that's okay. There's certainly a place for that. I think there's also a place for the fanzines, with a longer, more considered pieces that we want to write about. And, we can also write serious reviews of particular books or films or magazines or whatever, TV programs. We can write longer reviews of these things and try to work out in our own mind what it is that we actually like about the stuff. Because I'm finding that as I get older is good for the brain as
Oh,
well,
yeah, I
because
think so too.
it makes me having to think about what it is I think about. It's making me consider why I think something is of worth or not of worth. And I've been thinking just recently about, because I've been, as you know, and a few other people on know this about this podcast know that I've been getting back into fanzine publications again over the last couple of years. And I was having a think, well, the last couple of days, about why it was that I didn't do fanzines for a long period of time when I was actually still involved in science fiction fandom. Some of it was because I was spending all of my energies running conventions. But once that was over and I got past the, sort of the latent trauma that you basically have that you need to basically spend a couple of years just coming down from all the work that you've done, I think that there's, I was thinking about it, and I'm thinking that most of the writing that I was doing during my life was being done in my professional career, in the IT work that I was doing.
Yeah.
Now, I know there must be a Greek or Latin term for it, but I think there must be a certain thing that gives you a certain amount of daily writing energy
Yes.
or writing associated time that you can handle before the well is just dry, and then you need to have you need to sleep overnight, then you need to come back into it again, and then it's filled up, and then you can off you go again.
Yeah, that's very true.
I was finding that I was draining the well pretty much every day at work, and so that when I would come home, I just no, I could read, that was okay. I could watch television, but writing anything, no, completely gone because I'd used up all of that writing energy during the day. But now that I've got to the point where I've retired, I feel as though I've got it back again. In fact, I was missing it, not doing that writing. And then I realised that, oh, well, I could actually push that energy off into this way and go back to what I'd been doing back in the 70s and 80s and just reconnect with that again.
Well, that's certainly very much the case for me, because I was literally writing for a living for quite a while, as a, essentially as a journalist, and trying to come home after that and write very much, certainly any creative writing, like writing fiction, it was just way too hard. And then I moved on from writing words to writing code, and became a software developer, and that, believe it or not, is a very creative outlet, and uses up all the same amount of creative energy that you're talking about for other kinds of writing. And so the same thing happened there. But, so when I did retire about 10 years ago, I did get back into writing for, I had a burst of creativity, and I actually end up writing a lot of little short stories and wrote a novel. I don't know what my excuse is since then, but I haven't gone back to doing that sort of creative writing. But I'm enjoying doing the fanish writing and the reviews and so on, and doing the podcast, which again uses up a lot of the same sort of energy, I think.
Well, I think you have to think about things in a very similar way. We're thinking about why it is we like a particular book and trying to explain that to somebody. You can't come out and just say, "Oh, it's good, it's bad, yeah, this, that,
Oh,
and the
no, you've got
other."
to have reasons for it, yeah.
Part of my whole shtick about having the rating system that I have is to help me to try to quantify what I think about something. That doesn't work for everybody, but it works for me. My daughter, who reads some of the reviews I put up, and also reads my numbering, and sort of comes to me occasionally and said, "Why did you give that 3.7? And what's that different from 3.8?" And so I have to try to explain it to her. And but that's, I think that's a good thing because again, it's meaning that you're keeping lots of those different parts of your brain working. And as we all know, as we get older, that is a major thing that we need to be doing. We don't want to atrophy any part of it by basically sitting there and having something presented to us the whole time. We are actually out there producing something and try to create something to explain what it is we're thinking. Now, it's not going to work for everybody. Just so happens to work for the two of us, David, which is
Indeed.
interesting. It is. All right, I think we're probably about done for that. We're now going to move on to an interview I did earlier this week with, oddly enough, another Worldcon chair, Rose Mitchell. Rose was co-chair with me of the 2010 World Science Fiction Convention held here in Melbourne. But she came into fandom and into science fiction in a sort of a different way from the ways that we entered, David. So I started off by asking Rose exactly that. How did she get into science fiction? Hello, Rose.
Hi, Perry. Nice to be here.
Where did all this crazy SF stuff come to for you? Where'd you first come across it and why?
So where did it really start off with for me was, like every person, SF fans, I read it when I was a kid or a teenager, but I actually didn't really take it all that seriously until my marriage broke up. He took all the friends. I had to find new ones. Literally, I had to find new friends. And I'd seen ads on telly and in magazines and things like that about fan clubs. So I thought, swear word, swear word. I'll go and join these. I'll go and see what it's about. And I just rocked up.
Which
And
so which clubs did you go to?
the first one I went to was Enterprise. That was interesting. I mean, it was a fun afternoon. The second one I went to was OzTrek, and that's where I kind of found my people, my tribe, and it went from there. And I was able to share experiences. So that reading and TV and movie watching I'd done, other people
So
had.
did you? So did you find that those TV related fan groups weren't just solely dedicated and single-minded about the, say, Star Trek or Star Wars, but they actually use that as an entree into everything else in the field? Is that what you found?
I found that, but that was back in the day. So that was back in the, say, early 90s. And so it was a smorgasbord. It was a taste of everything. I don't think that that's how it is nowadays with the onset of the internet and gatekeepers and that sort of thing. But back in the day, that certainly was my experience. And I think everybody else's, if you talk to anyone else who came through that way, it's the same thing. You find your tribe.
So these were all based in Melbourne, that you found in all these. Did you just restrict yourself just to the one fan group, or did you move around and
Moved around. So
saw other clubs?
saw other clubs. I was not faithful. No, but it was the same people. And back in the day, as you well know, because you're an old-time fan, back in the day, our group was rather small. Our community was rather small. Nowadays, it's millions of people are involved. Back in the day, it was hundreds. And so it was the same people, and there was lots of clubs happening particularly in Melbourne, and I believe Perth. But I couldn't afford to travel to Perth. There was probably half a dozen or more. There was groups out at Dandenong, and which was just a general science fiction group that met on a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon. There was one at Bendigo or Ballarat. They were all over the shop because, A, there wasn't the internet as well, or the massive amount of entertainment that you have now. So you went out and made friends and entertained yourself.
Yes, this was at a time when if you wanted to watch old reruns of SF programs on television, that you either pretty much had to have VHS or DVDs or whatever you could possibly get, CDs that you'd actually pirated or copied from friends. No. You just lent to you so that you could actually have a bit of a look at it. Oh, no, I shouldn't say.
It was mainly VHS tapes, unless you were lucky to, and there was, and people were very, very, very generous. Would have old 35 and 8 mil copies of films.
Yep.
And so would organise a film night somewhere, and it was nothing to hire some crappy old hall somewhere and do that.
Yep.
You'd all rock up, bring a plate, a bottle, and
So they were mostly social events. Is there anything else that you got involved in at that time? I mean, was it just basically meeting up and watching TV and TV programs and films in a group, or were you doing other things?
So I saw what other people were doing. So fanzines, running the clubs, being organising events, conventions, all of that sort of stuff. And you know me, Perry.
I do know you, Rose.
I fancy doing that. I'm going to do that.
Right.
So I got it more and more involved.
Okay, so you saw that as being, did you see that as becoming the major part of your social life at that stage? Was that what was happening?
Yeah, it was the part of my social life apart from my family. So it was my major social outlet. I also had mother's clubs, school things. You know, as a parent, you can involve parents' clubs. But the main social one was the clubs. And some of those people I'm still lifelong friends with. I'm still, we still meet up regularly. We still communicate. Yeah.
They
were good friends.
Yeah, really. they become lifelong friends because you have a sort of a common interest, and then you find out that that's not the only thing that you have in common, and that you've got a whole lot of other things. Right. And that's what I think is one of the major things about fandom, that you meet people that are over a like mind at one instance, at one level, but then you find out they're like mind at lots of other levels as well.
Yeah, but also, fandom is much more accepting. So your flaws, while not ignored, are tolerated.
Mm.
That seems strange coming from me because you know how intolerant I am. that's me just getting older and grumpier. But, people, the social awkwardnesses of things were ignored.
Yeah.
Because you shared a common community.
Yep, common interests, and then a common community came with that. Now, you mentioned that there was things like, social events and fanzines. And were you going to any conventions at that time?
No, not a lot, because I was a single mum and I had two kids at school. And I was on it wasn't a bad wage, but it's hard work because I wasn't getting any child support because he connived his way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tough for me. It wasn't until my first child actually left school and started working. So she got an apprenticeship. She decided she wanted to work because she was sick of being poor as well and deferred academic study, that I found I started to have some spare cash. So I could go to conventions. And this is something I have been thinking about lately because of the various internet tirades about inclusivity and, opening things up, is conventions that are extremely middle class. Yeah, you've got to be cashed up, really, to participate. It's not like going to a local footy club or not local netball club or anything like that. They're expensive by comparison.
Well, if you go to local footy clubs, you've still got to pay your dues and your subs each year.
Yeah.
So there is a there's just got to be a financial contribution from somebody, somewhere, in order for the event to actually happen and so that people can attend.
Yeah.
And, you can't have the same people putting money forward all the time. I know.
No, but it is
difficult, I understand, for people with not much money to be able to get a foothold and come in and actually get started in it. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the, in back in the day, so a convention, the big gate shows were cheap, and they still are, because that's their audience, is to get them through the gate by spending little money. They catch you on the other side, of course, with merch. But back in the day, I think the first one I went to was a couple of they were Starfleet or something like that. They were a mob out of Arizona or Nevada who ran gate shows, and that was the first one. So that was cheap. That was only, I think, $70 to attend for 2 days.
Yeah, that's nothing much these days. No. But back then it was a bit of money. I mean, I know that if you're a student, for example, $70 would be very hard to find.
Yeah. Well, a single mum who has to weigh, you know, I spend that $70 or do my children and then consequently my children eat rice for the rest of the week. I certainly save for it, because it was a long time coming, so there was plenty of advance notice. So this was the early 90s too.
Right.
Plenty of advance notice, because there was limited places to market it. So they wanted to catch Slow Glass, places like that, you know, Minotaur, Alternate Worlds. There was a big ads in there. Fanzines, of course, carried the ads for them.
Mm-hmm.
And you got some discounts for that. Went and worked for them. You got some discounts.
So did you actually start working for any of those conventions when you had a chance?
No, I couldn't commit to it at that point. It wasn't
Again, it was family commitments came first.
Yep. So it wasn't until my eldest left school.
Okay, so when did things start to change in that regard? Because you and I met up sometime in the late 90s.
The late 90s. It was 99, and I remember this clearly, actually. It was probably mid-ish 90s. By then, I was heavily involved in Austrac. I was president or vice president on alternate years. I was captain's log editor. I was a bane of certain other Star Trek clubs, president's life.
We better not go into that bit. It might be either libelous or scandalous or one of the
other. Yeah, we won't, but yeah. And so things started to change. And so I sold the family home because I could no longer afford the mortgage.
Right.
It wasn't so much the mortgage, it was the repairs. As you know, as a homeowner, if you don't keep the repairs up, your house goes to
wreck and ruin. Yeah.
Rubber. So I decided to sell the family home. And I moved into Brunswick, around the corner from the MSFC, which provided me another outlet because I knew most of these people. And Beverly Hope invited me along. Oh, you must come down. So I did.
Mm-hmm. Had you had any contact with the Melbourne Science Fiction Club?
A couple of times, yeah.
Oh, okay. So yeah, prior to that. Yep, okay. And that became another social grouping that
that became the main Friday. That was the Friday night highlight for best part of 20 years.
Okay.
And I think we would have met, I'm pretty sure it was late 90s, and I distinctly remember this. It was a stinking hot night around the MSFC. We were all sitting outside because the hall was too hot, and Donna Heenan and Michael Jordan sat opposite where I was, just staring at me. And next thing, they come over and said, "We've got a proposition. How would you like to work on 99? Work on in 99? Oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I'd really like to go, but I haven't been able to commit yet, blah, blah, blah." So that's when they contrived around Julian Lucy's, actually, to meet you, and you interviewed me around the kitchen table. Yes.
Crocky. You've got a better memory than I have.
And obviously I passed muster.
Well, you must have. Well, we're still here, still talking to each other, still having a beer on Friday nights.
Friday nights, we've worked together on several projects and not hated each other.
Well, only a little bit. No, I know. I'm only having a lend of you. So you got into 1999 and ended up being treasurer of that convention. How was that?
I, looking back on it, if I'd known what I know now,
You would have run as fast as you possibly could the other way, is that right?
it would have been a whole when I saw those two plotting and what are they up to? It was let me have a think about that. But I had no idea because I'd never been to a Worldcon, but I'd read all the stories about it, you know, that from fanzines and trip reports and stuff like that, and was deeply envious that people were able to go, deeply envious. And I couldn't see that I'd be able to ever go to a Worldcon until my children had all both of them had left school. So was it not, well, 99, 99, of course. And airfares, air travel was still a bit pricey. And it wasn't until late noughties that that the cut price thing started to come in and airfares became cheap. So I thought, oh, I'd really like to do that. And I have no fear. I truly have no fear. I've just had a performance review at work, and that was what we talked about, my courage. Because if a project's offered to me, I'll have a crack at it. If I can't do it, then it's that collaboration back saying I'm struggling here, I need help. But if a project's offered to me, I'll have a crack.
So you got through 99 without killing anybody or being killed, which is always a big
Oh, I don't
bonus.
know. I think there was a couple.
There was a couple left by the roadside, unfortunately, but there we go. That's what's going to happen. Some people's expectations or ambitions can sometimes overpower their common sense, shall we say, and
Your abilities.
and also their ability, and they can end up. Well, it's always a big major problem dealing with conventions because you're dealing with volunteers the whole time, and as we've discussed on a number of occasions, it really is like herding cats, trying to get people to do things. They say they're going to do it, and then they really don't commit, and they don't do the work. And then, right at the last minute, say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't be able to do that anymore." And they leave you in the lurch because they've been promising, 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 and then just pull out. But I can say, Rose, without a shadow of a doubt, that wasn't what you did. You basically got in and stuck in and really, really got into it in a big way. So, did the 99 Worldcon change your view of how you dealt with fandom and what you did?
No, it wasn't 99 that changed my view on how I dealt with fandom.
Oh, okay.
No, actually, it broadened it a bit more because I got to meet all of these people that I'd only ever read about because they all came to Melbourne. Well, not all of them, of course, but a good, jolly good deal of them came to Melbourne, and I hung out with them. And you know, it was nothing. You know, Peggy Ray Pavlik came to my house, and it's you know.
Well, I must say, she'd actually changed her name to Sapienza at that stage
Oh,
because
she had to,
this was her honeymoon trip, so in
she had,
99.
but I, yeah, that was, yeah, they just got married,
Sorry,
and you know,
I'm being nitpicky here, but
so you
that's
know,
all.
you're just being a fan.
Sorry.
See, I'm tolerant of that because I've just become used to people nitpicking.
No, she was a wonder, one of those great fans who was tremendous to meet and get to know.
Every time I went,
Heart as big as the moon, basically, that woman.
but knew her shit
Oh yeah.
and knew how to problem solve, and she could, and was a really good negotiator, and an advocate. So she could hose problems down. She could find solutions. You know, she was someone I admired deeply.
I remember her helping me at the 99 convention. A couple of things that she said to me at various times were of great help, and I was very appreciative of what she said. So she's a great loss to fandom.
Indeed, she is.
So 99's gone. We moved into the 21st century in the year 2000 or 2001. So where are we there? What are we up to? What are our aims and ambitions in the year 2001?
So after many drunken nights at the convention, because by then I didn't have to worry about children being home alone, because my children were adults then, and could fend for themselves. So I'd go out carousing all night, which I did. So people were enthused. So all of us, there was, I think it was Janice Gell pointed out that I can't remember what the percentage was now, but it was a majority, Perry. So you ran a convention where you had most of your committee and committee members and departmental heads and things were all novices, had never been to a Worldcon, but had taken on this high duty. So we came out of it, there was a lot of us actually came out of it on a real high, because 99 was a success, despite some of stumbles along the way. But
So,
no
look,
one.
they're all look, well, running a Worldcon's a massive event. You're going to have some stumbles. I
It's
think we
all.
came. I think we came through that one pretty well.
So we went on to, I think we formed a, we kept Vic SF going. So you were there, there was a few others, and we started running either NatCons or little conventions or events and things with a view to bring Worldcon back to Australia again at some point, but also to train up, mentor young people into running much more conventions. And after 99, you saw an absolute plethora of conventions, not gate shows with big stars, but conventions as we know it, start up. So out of that came Conflux and Continuum. SwanCon got a new lease of life because the Perth people went back with new ideas and bigger and better sort of thing, new contacts. It just all seemed to kick off. There was little groups starting up, and they'd have one day mini conventions, as they were called. Yeah, it all just seemed to start rolling from then. And so I was involved with that. By this time, I'm actually not involved with AUSTRAC anymore, because you sensible people realise that they've got to clear their plate. They cannot have many things going.
When you're working as well, I mean,
And
if
when
you
you're
work, if you're
working.
working, I mean, when you're retired, you get to the point where you put so much on your plate, you think you've got to drop the whole bloody thing because you just take on too much. But anyway, that's a story for another day. So you're basically continuing to work, and you're helping out with conventions and chaired a national convention, I believe.
Yep, two NatCons, 2002 and 2007. By then, I had cash, or spare cash, because both of my children left school or finished school and were out working. So I had no dependent children, so I started to travel. So I could go to conventions overseas. Had a ball doing that, an absolute ball. We started bidding for 2010. Well, we didn't start it. It was started for us by.
People who shall remain nameless, but who know who they are.
We know who they are. And there's disputes now about who actually did it, because.
Well, the story I goes, oh, forget it. We'll just basically name names. I heard that the story was that Stephen Boucher had said something in a room party at a Worldcon and muttered about how they could do it better back in Australia, and people started throwing $20 notes. And so, right, okay, here you are, you do it.
So there's a feud about whether it was Mark Olson or Joseph Clary that chucked the first $20 note.
That'd be right. One of those two probably is bound to have done it.
And both convinced it was them who did
Yeah,
it.
yeah. Oh, well, you wasn't claim responsibility for something like that, because and then it basically started off, and I remember that I was chair of the Victorian Science Fiction Conventions Incorporated, which was the board that oversaw the 99 convention and was set up to carry on and run through to the 2010 convention.
Yep, that's right.
And we went and appointed you as chair of the 2010 convention.
Well, co-chair, Perry.
No, it was, you started off as chair.
Oh, did I?
Oh, yeah. I seem to recall this very, very distinctly. I was dragged in at the back end. Certain person decided that although they could handle the management of a convention, standing up and talking in front of people really wasn't their bag. And it was decided that probably best then that we had two, one that did the standing up and talking, namely me.
Oh, yeah, now I remember.
And somebody who did all the hard slog, namely you.
Yeah, I remember that now. Pity that, because, see, that's where I didn't show courage. I should have, because since that time I've actually been coached and done courses and things like that from, so a reasonably confident. I don't think I could stand up on the Sydney Opera stage, but Opera House stage, but
generally the major thing you've got to remember is that 98% of the people in the audience are glad they're not where you are. And if you think that that's the case and that you're confident about what you're going to say and you can speak in a way that is going to get the point across, you'll generally be able to do a reasonable job. Nobody expects everybody to be a massive orator like some of the best. You just have to do a competent job. And if you do a competent job, you're going to do okay.
And so, keep it short and sharp.
Yeah, don't keep rabbiting on like certain people like me do. If I get my wind up, that's it.
Yeah. So I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, that's right. I did. Yeah.
So anyway, no, well, that's all right though. So, again, 2010 worked out okay. I don't think it probably had to kick on after 2010 that 99 did, because there'd been a big gap between world cons in Australia between 1999 and. Between 1999 and 1985, it's 14 years.
Mm.
And, you know, there wasn't the sort of ongoing reminder of things that you get with the internet, where there's always things happening that you get, you know that they're there and you've got a lot more information about Worldcons because they're there in front of you the whole time. But between 1999 and 2010, that was the case. And then after 2010, of course, it's carried on. So 2010, we finish that, we get through that, decide that we've basically had enough and that we don't want to do any more with this, and so we close it all down, thinking that hopefully somebody in the future will pick it up and run with it.
Well, we kept it open for 2 years, remember?
Yeah, we did.
As we cleaned up.
Yep.
We're going to say cleaned up, we tied off all the loose ends.
Yep.
And we just couldn't find anyone that was really interested in carrying on or had the same vision as Vic SF.
Yep.
Plenty of people wanted to do it, but they didn't want to do it.
Yeah, no, it's this classic idea. A lot of people want the kudos but don't want to do the work.
Yeah.
And it's being a Worldcon chair is a heck of a lot of work. It's like a second job, isn't it?
It is a second job, and if I had my time over again...
You never would have done it.
I would have, yeah. Oh no, that's unfair. I probably would have, but I probably would have approached it differently. So once again, performance review week. I've had a lot of reflection on what did I do well, what did I could have done better.
Yeah, it's always this this idea that everything's easier in hindsight, and you think,
easier in hindsight.
I could actually run a better one again next time, and that's when you have to basically sort of slap yourself in the face and say, you know, you're not doing that again.
Having said that, Perry, that it's a whole different environment now, and you, me and David Grigg have many times sat over a beer on a Friday night after and talked about some controversy that's gone on during the week, and all of us, three of us, just going, oh, we wouldn't do this ever again.
No.
Because it's unlike a business where you can call people out, punish them, for breaking policy or doing something unethical or against the rules or anything like that, or are just plain disruptive. So they're not, you don't want them in your team, so you get rid of them. Volunteers you can't
no.
just yeah,
There's so few and far between on the, they're so thin on the
yeah.
ground in Australia that you have to, you take what you have and you work with what you've got. So
Yeah.
you spend most of your time people managing, trying to get people to come around to
Absolutely.
the working the way that you would like to them to work, or trying to work out how they work and how that will fit in with the way
Yeah.
that you can work so that you end up getting to the same result that you need to get to.
Yeah, and getting them up to speed is like, don't so many times I saw over the last 30 years, don't reinvent the wheel. Why are you reinventing the wheel? But inevitably they do.
And you keep seeing the same things going wrong, and you sort of
Yeah.
wonder, oh no, you're not doing that again, are you? We've done all that already. But
Yeah.
people don't like being told that, and as I found when I was working, but let's not get into that either, because that's another whole topic of conversation. And so moving through into the 2010s, and not much is happening in Australia, and then there's this bid to run a World Science Fiction Convention in New Zealand, which seems to start
Right.
getting a bit more legs.
That happened at 2010, if you
Yeah, I
remember.
know. I think I might have been around about one of the times when some of those conversations were being held, and I was trying to run as fast as I could the other way to get away from them.
Yeah. No, it started off because there was a convention, the New Zealand NatCon tacked itself onto the beginning of 2010, and rightly so. It was a good business decision. So they could take advantage and leverage some of the visitors. So, because a lot of the air routes would come via Auckland, or it wouldn't have been a pain for people, say, in the US or Japan to go to Auckland or Wellington first, then on to Melbourne. Now, we were already sitting when this happened. No, we were already going. And so they brought on, they had the NatCon, and once again, in a bar, 20 bucks started, notes started flying around. Oh, New Zealand, you should do this. And that's how it started. By the time they got to us a week later, it was a bid. And they
It was
asked,
already starting to roll.
and they needed a bid table.
So it really started to roll pretty
Yeah.
much straight away.
Straight away. So, yeah. So it was 10 years.
And
My
about
advice, hindsight for people who are bidding and running these things, 10 years is far too long.
but 3 or 4 years is a little bit too short. I reckon you need 6 to 7, because you've got 2 years, six, I would reckon. Start off, you think you need about six. But
I'd go
anyway, we
five.
could five. Okay,
Five
all right,
or six.
I'll give you five, but by 5, you have to get up and start running pretty quickly,
Yeah.
because you have to be, by 3 years out, you have to be flat out 3 years out.
Yeah, but it's only 2 years now, remember?
Yeah,
So,
I know, but it's 2 years
but
from
in
the time
1 year solid bidding.
1 year solid bidding, but so you need to build up to it. So you need to get your processes in place. You need to get everything, all your organisation, the people worked out how you're
If
going to do it, and off you go. So,
people didn't reinvent the wheel, it'd already be there for them.
yep, it would be. Yep, and we've got lots of ideas about how that happens, and just got to wait for people to ask us if they want to.
Yeah.
So around about,
And documented, Perry, because you know what I'm like about
Oh yeah,
documenting
I'm sure
documentation.
you've got it all written down somewhere. So 2017, you actually get a phone call from somebody in New Zealand.
Yes. Well, first of all, it was an email actually
Oh, okay.
that prepared me.
And the question was, did you want to be fan guest of honour at the New Zealand World Science Fiction Convention?
That's right. So that was a bit of soul searching and discussions with people who were not part of fandom because I couldn't discuss it with any of
No,
you
you can't. You're
guys.
not allowed to.
My daughter and a friend of mine who's not in fandom but looks on my activities quite fondly and amusingly. And I had to really think about whether, because I didn't think I was worthy enough. What have I done that makes me worthwhile? And I really, and I, it's that introspection, not introspection, that self-awareness, I suppose. Self-esteem, yeah,
Self-confidence.
Because so, and self-confidence, and what have I done that I deserve this? Because I was thinking about all the other people that have gone before me. So what was it? What were they? There were 79 or something, weren't they?
I don't know.
Fair enough. I can't remember now. It was a 70-something Worldcon. So all of these people, you know, who were much more esteemed, as I could, I thought, esteemed, you know, famous, respected. You know, what about, you know, what, why have they chosen me or asked me? And as you and I know, there'd be a list, because someone said,
probably
you go on to the next one. So I really had to have a big think about it, and I took 4 weeks to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And seriously think about it. I had a couple of conversations with Norman about why me.
Mm-hmm.
And he convinced you. Out the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And which I then thought, I hadn't looked at it that way, or shit, I'd forgotten about all of that.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, you've had large contacts with New Zealand fandom for quite some time.
Quite some time, yeah. Mm.
And you've maintained those over the journey.
I have. Mm. I have. And introduced you guys to it, if I remember
rightly. Yes. So it's unfortunate that the New Zealand convention had to be an online convention. Well, it's really, really sad. I mean, we've had lots of conversations about this, about all the hard work they had to put in, and then to have it sort of, I know it's still a convention, but it's not the same thing. I mean,
no, it's not the same thing.
Having people actually in your city wandering around where you can sit down and have a talk to and have a beer with, just on their own, and can take them out for dinner and see them just on their own.
Yeah, and that, seeing your work come together as you walk the decks.
Yep.
And see, oh my God, we've done this. I knew about it, of course, before the announcement, because they contacted me and told Norman and Kelly contacted me and told me what was going to happen, and was I still prepared to go on? And I actually cried for them.
Oh yeah.
I just thought 10 years of all of that work, and then you pipped at the post because they're only 3 months out.
We were talking earlier on about how there was a big flush of fanish energy that came through after 1999, and similarly the same thing happened in 1975, that there's all of this activity that kicks off, and a lot of it is because people come in with energy and ideas, and they have people that you've looked up to, that you've corresponded with, or you've met overseas and you want to meet again. And suddenly there they are in your hometown, and you can have a chat to them and talk about specific things and run things past them. And it energizes you. Unfortunately, poor old New Zealand wasn't able to achieve that. And I think it's just been, it's been very, very unfortunate. And it's now looking like they may be the only one that it's going to end up being an online Worldcon, because Washington this year looks like being face-to-face in December now.
Yeah, See how that one goes, Perry.
Yeah, well, we will. But, you know, but it's basically it's very unfortunate for them in the end.
Yeah, kudos to New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
To the team.
Absolutely.
Soon as they knew or realised that the borders were going to shut and this pandemic was truly a pandemic, and it wasn't all fear mongering, and our lives were going to change for years, it feels like, this weekend.
Yep. Well, because I should mention that we're talking here during when we're all in a 7-day hard lockdown in Melbourne.
Our fourth.
Yep.
And only less than 10% of it are vaccinated, because our government.
Let's not go there, but we're moving on. that'll derail the whole conversation if we do that one.
Yeah. I'm just ranting up now.
So. All right. Okay.
But they were able to pivot pretty damn quickly.
Yeah, they did a very, very good job.
And yeah, I mean, some more things worked for them, some didn't, but they didn't know. They had no time to test it.
Yeah. No, I think they've done a pretty
good job of what they delivered.
I think they did a sterling job. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that coming through the way they did was fairly spectacular. It's just unfortunate for New Zealand fandom overall that they're probably not going to have another Worldcon for another generation at least, and they're going to miss out on all that flow through, which is...
Yeah, well, it looks like to me. We don't get sorted, you know, it's like their NatCon, which I thought was at Easter time, but it wasn't, but I may be wrong. So they're not going to have probably much of a convention scene until next year,
yep.
Just the same as here in Australia.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Until they can get back to face-to-face meetings, it's not really going to be a convention thing. You know, we could have conversations about what online events are like, but they're not the same.
They're not the same.
By long chalk. So where to for Rose Mitchell now? Worldcon treasurer, Worldcon co-chair, Worldcon fan, guest of honour. Where to next?
Yeah. I mean, I'm officially now in retirement because between 2010 and January this year, I was also involved with the Australian Science Fiction Foundation and president for last probably 3 years, I think it was. But I've now fully retired. I've got nothing. I'm not involved in any activities at the moment. And that's come as a result of COVID. It's like, you know, I'm just going to day by day. So nowhere at the moment except meeting you guys on a Friday night for beers to talk about the state of the world, our medications, our superannuation and our retirement plans.
Yes, it's odd how conversations shift over the time from mortgages to retirement, don't they, as you
yes,
get older?
Indeed.
Yeah. But ailments seem to stay all the way right through for some reason. You keep on talking to people and there's always something that they're talking about. Oh, I've got this medical condition or that one. That it's just the nature of the medical conditions changes over time. You know, early days they're fairly slight. Later on they can become rather major. But luckily enough, most of us are.
Well, I think our group, all of us, are reasonably healthy, except for the ailments that might be expected
of people in their 60s
our age.
And into their 70s. Yep.
So I've been doing a lot of reading. We were talking about this earlier. I've decided to, I shouldn't really admit this in public. Treat the Hugo seriously.
Ooh, yes, that is a fairly major confession.
So I'm reading everything and making critique on everything.
Well, I think we might have to take that as a pointer to have a chat to you about that stuff later on the podcast. But I think we're done for the day, Rose. Thank you very much for your discussion this afternoon. You've had a very interesting career, if we can call it that, or a life in fandom. I think you've done quite a fair number of things over the journey.
Yeah, I have actually. So it was New Zealand when it all had to be put together.
Yep.
That I came to realise, I've done a lot in 30 years.
Yep.
To which people, my own family, one of Faith, my daughter whom you met, she's in printing. And so she was helping Spike and somebody else, I can't remember who the other person was now, put together the fake fanzine that highlighted my life.
Oh.
And I kept getting messages about, oh, I forgot you'd done such and such. Oh my God, I forgot about this. Oh, look at you here. You know, I forgot that. And so my kids have more or less been on the journey as well. But thank you for a relaxed and enjoyable reminisce.
Good.
And we didn't even touch on my fan feuds.
No, stayed away from those very deliberately, I think. Thank you, Rose. We shall talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for all that. Interesting discussion. It is good to talk to other people about how they came to find this thing we call science fiction fandom and what it has provided for them over the years. And it's interesting to see the similarities, but also the differences between us all. And that's a very, Rose came into things differently from the way that I did, and I think the way that you did, and it's very interesting to hear how that happened. So that's great.
Indeed.
I think we're done for the week.
Yeah, we are. What about next episode, Perry?
Well, next episode, because you keep telling everybody that I'm the one that sets the agenda, but I
You
don't
are,
know.
yeah.
Oh no. Look, I put up the suggestions and then you
Knock
agree
them
to
back.
them.
Well, I don't often knock them back. Very rare.
No, very rare.
I generally, it's generally a matter of rescheduling something
Well,
else.
it
That's
is,
all.
we
Yeah.
generally will get around to doing things, but we sort of roll through things, sort of go things on a sort of a not a regular schedule, but we basically like to we'll come back to things that we've done previously. And our next episode is going to be about crime fiction.
Indeed.
And in particular, we both have read the one book
Yes.
which we shall talk about next time. So we'll both have our own views about this particular book. And it's about, I can give you the hint, it's by an Australian author that we have discussed fairly often on this particular podcast. And this is about their new novel,
The latest. Yep.
their latest one. All right, David, we're
Okay.
done.
Cool. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
All right, see you then, David. Thanks
All
very
right.
much.
Ciao.
Bye.